Good morning, everybody.
I'm glad to see all of you this morning, and I greatly appreciate the prayers and the songs that we've been able to participate in together this morning. Hope this is the beginning of a good week for all of you. I'd like to ask everybody for just a moment to think of your very, very favorite, most favorite school experience. Either your school experience back in the day when you were involved in it, or your school experience so far. What has been your most favorite thing? Was it sitting with your friends at the lunchroom table? Was it playing games on the playground, which all involved touching or tackling or swinging on the same equipment together, or something like that? Was it playing with in the band room with all the band or orchestra members? Was it playing a sport, a team sport that involved high fives and hugs and all kinds of encouragement like that? Was it the bus ride home with everybody all packed together? What was your favorite, your most favorite? Was it graduation with everyone all together and the room filled with your classmates and loved ones? Which was it so far? And then ask yourself this. How would it be different? How would that memory, that experience, be different this year? How will it be? All of us know that we're in a moment of time which is different from our experience so far. So it would greatly bless us, I think, if we were able to zoom out and take a much broader view, of a much wider, much deeper view of human experience, and try to understand who we are, both individually and as a people, and who we are in relation to God, and in fact, who our God is in view of the broader view, the broader perspective of things. I think Psalm 78 offers us the blessing of that perspective. It offers us an opportunity to look at things, to understand things, even to have a grasp of the educational process that is wider and more profound and more meaningful. So I'd like to use this wonderful psalm to ask us to think in that way for these next few minutes about school days, and not just school days where you go to school, but school days in God's views, God's efforts to educate people, a people of His own, to walk with Him and to be at home in His family. Psalm 78 is a story psalm. It's one of four or five of the psalms. This is the first one of this type in the collection of the psalms. It, not to discourage you, but it's the second longest of the psalms. But to encourage you, it's only about half as long as the longest psalm. It is a psalm which tells the story of God's dealings with His people. It tells the story twice in two different ways, but it tells it in both cases to try to show that what God has done to have a people for Himself. This is very, very much the story of Jesus, too, because it leads up, it shows why His work is necessary and so important. Let's begin with understanding this psalm just briefly. The first few verses of Psalm 78 introduce it and give us the things that I'm about to mention. It has a stated purpose. The purpose of this psalm is to share with another generation sayings which have been given from God of old times. Verse 3 says, things we've heard and known that our fathers have told us. And then it says, we will not hide them from their children, but tell them to the coming generation. Here is the same view of the educational process that we would find in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2 in the New Testament. The idea of taking what we have heard and experiencing it ourselves and then passing it along to our children so that they indeed can tell the coming generation. And the words consist of three things at the end of verse 4. First, the glorious deeds of the Lord. NIV translates it, the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord. American Standard translates it, just the praises of the Lord. And then His might, or His strength, or His power. And then thirdly, and most importantly, the wonders He has done in history, within history and within nature. The wonderful things God has done in real human experience to show who He is and how much He cares and what He wants for His people and how far He's willing to go to have that for His people. Our faith is different as Christians. It does not simply consist of the sayings of some wise magi of some sort. It does not consist simply of experiences or emotional meditations. It consists of what God has done in history. And it's told or experienced by the telling. So the premise now that happens as a basis for this work that this psalm undertakes is in verses 5 through 7. The premise is He established a testimony in Jacob, meaning He made Himself known. He spoke to the people through Moses and appointed a law in Israel, as you know He did at Mount Sinai, which He commanded to our fathers to teach their children. He does this over and over in Deuteronomy. He gives them things to do that makes their children ask, what does this mean? And then He wants them told about this. Deuteronomy 6, verses 20 and 21 would be an example. The purpose of this is that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. The idea is that in a relational setting, where people have connections to each other, parents to children and so forth, in that setting, the wonders that God has done should be retold for the purpose not simply of having had information communicated or passed along, but for the purpose of that next generation being able to set their hope in God, to be confident in Him and not to forget His works, but to keep His commandments. That's the premise. The premise is that faith in God can be a part of multi-generational life, just as surely by the telling of the wonders that God has done as by His doing those wonders all over again. The same sense of awe, the same sense of gratitude, the same sense of joy can be known in the hearing of what God has done as in the seeing of it. And then the point of this psalm is in verse 8. And it is that the fathers did not, it says here, the point is that they should not be like their fathers. So this isn't one of the stories like I might tell my children. When I was your age and we started to school, we had to go barefoot and we had to walk 2 miles to catch the bus. And we had to do that all in cold, and then we had to come home and do our chores till past dark. That's not the kind of story that this is. This is the deal where that you need to know what God did with the fathers so that you're not like the fathers. A stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast and whose spirit was not faithful to the Lord. What you learn from that is that God wants a people whose hearts are steadfast and whose spirits are faithful to Him. And He wants that by the teaching or the retelling of His story. Sometimes we talk, each of us talks about my story. This is our story that God wants told and wants known. Now, the point of this psalm leads to two large sections of the psalm. Each of these two sections is told to make one point, and it is that God's people have tended to forget Him and not to be steadfast and not to be faithful. Verse 9 compares them to a group of people who turned back on the day of battle. Right when they're most needed and when their faith in God is at stake, they turn and go the other way. They leave everybody else with the battle. You can't depend on them. A little later in verse 57, it speaks of them as if they are a deceitful bow. The idea being that you grab your, what was then the weapon that you used in battle, and it shoots crooked. It's of no use. That's the way God's people turned out to be to Him. So I can't improve on this psalm and the telling of the story and its vivid details and its comparisons and so forth. So I'd like to read the two sections with you. If it helps you, just close your eyes and imagine what this is saying to us. In each case, we're told that God's people forgot Him, so He interceded in history or in nature and made Himself known. He rescued them, and then He provided for them, and they kept on sinning, and judgment came, the consequences of their sin came, and then He had compassion on them anyway. And then they forgot again, and then He rescued them again, and then He provided for them again, and then they sinned again, and then judgment came, and God is merciful to them anyhow. That's very much the two parts of this story. The first big part starts at verse 10, and it goes through verse 39. And this involves God's wonders, the wonders that He has done, and particularly using nature in behalf of His people. So think about this with us. Verse 10, they didn't keep God's covenant, but refused to walk in His law. They forgot His works and the wonders that He had shown them. In the sight of their fathers, He performed wonders in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan. Zoan was a city in Egypt, maybe in the northeast Nile Delta, and maybe where they had to live as slaves and make bricks of mud. He divided the sea and let them pass through it and made the waters stand like a heap. In the daytime He led them with the cloud and all the night with the fiery light. He split rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock and caused waters to flow like the rivers. Yet, they sinned more, still more against Him, rebelling against the Most High God in the desert. They tested God in their heart. And by the way, in this psalm, testing God means you challenge Him to do what you really don't think He can, to prove Himself. And that they tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, "Can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. Can He also give bread or provide meat for His people?" Therefore, when the Lord heard, He was full of wrath. A fire kindled against Jacob, and His anger rose against Israel because they did not believe in God and did not trust His saving power. Yet He commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, And he rained down on them manna to eat, and he gave them the grain of heaven. Man ate the bread of angels. He sent them food in abundance. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he led out the south wind. He rained meat on them like dust, winged birds like the sand of the seas. He let them fall in the midst of the camp all around their dwellings, and they ate and were filled, for he gave them what they craved. But before they had satisfied their craving, while their food was still in their mouths, the anger of God rose against them, and he put to death the strongest of them and laid low the men of Israel. You'll remember the plague that involved. In spite of all this, they still sinned. Despite his wonders, they did not believe. So he made their days vanish like a breath, or vanish in a vapor, and their years a terror. When he put them to death, they sought him. But they repented and sought God earnestly. They remembered that God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer. But they flattered him with their mouths. They lied to him with their tongues. Their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not faithful to his covenant. Yet he, being compassionate or being merciful, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. He restrained his anger often and did not stir up all his wrath. He remembered. They may not have remembered, but he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes and comes not again. That's the first part. The second part begins now at verse 40. And this time, God's wonders are shown in the realm of history, what he does with nations. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. They tested God often, or again and again. It's how often God did this and how often they did this, and again provoked the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his hand or the day when he redeemed them from the foe. Now we're going to describe, the writer is, how he redeemed them from Egypt, what he did to the pagan gods of Egypt. When he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the fields of Zoan, he turned their rivers to blood so that they could not drink of their streams. He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them and frogs which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the destroying locust and the fruit of their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. He gave over their cattle to the hail and their flocks to thunderbolts. He let loose his anger on them, his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death. He gave their lives over to the plague. He struck down every firstborn in Egypt, the first fruits of their strength in the tents of Ham. Ham being a name for their tribes, their people. Then he led out his people like sheep. He guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them in safety so that they were not afraid. But the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And he brought them, his people, to his holy land, to the mountain which his right hand had won, his power. He drove out nations before them. He apportioned them for a possession and settled the tribes of Israel in their tents. Verse 56, yet They tested and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep His testimonies, but turned away and acted treacherously like their fathers. They twisted like a deceitful bow. They provoked Him to anger with their high places. They moved Him to jealousy with their idols. Now, please notice what he's saying. God judged the idols of Egypt. Then His own people, once settled in their inheritance, turned to idols like the nations. When God heard, He was full of wrath, and He utterly rejected Israel. He forsook His dwelling at Shiloh, where the tabernacle was set up first in the promised land, and the tent where He dwelt among mankind. And He delivered His power, thought here to stand for the Ark of the Covenant, to captivity, His glory into the hand of the foe. Remember, the Philistines took it, they captured it. He gave His people over to the sword and vented His wrath on His heritage. Fire devoured their young men. New American Standard translates it, His young men. Their young women had no marriage song. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. Then the Lord woke as from sleep, like a strong man shouting because of wine. Isn't that a kind of a daring way to express God's action? And He put His adversaries to rout. He put them to everlasting shame. He rejected the tent of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but He chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which He loves. Now notice He has chosen Judah as the tribe for the king to come from, Mount Zion or Jerusalem as the place. He built His sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth which He has founded forever. And then He chose David, His servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the nursing ewes. He brought him to shepherd Jacob, His people, Israel, His inheritance. With an upright heart, he, David, shepherded them and guided them with His skillful hand. And that leaves the psalm leaves us hanging. All right, what happens then? Knowing the first two rounds of the story, what would you think happened then? Would you suspect the same things would occur until God intervened with the perfect shepherd? That's what I would expect. I'd like to take this psalm and real quickly make four applications for all of us. I believe these four things will be meaningful to those of you who are going back to school. But I want to say they applied to all of us profoundly. If we want our hearts to be right and our spirits to be faithful, these four things are important. First, know the story. This is our story. Tell me the story of Jesus right on my heart, every word. Tell me the story most precious, sweetest I've ever heard. The telling of these stories is meant to write God's dealings with His people on our hearts, and is meant to help us understand who we are as persons and how we relate to each other and how we relate to God. Those are all things our culture at large is having great trouble with, and are all things that the faith of Christ contributes to. These things written beforehand were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, may have what? Hope. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning at verse 11, says, "Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has taken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but will with the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. That's what Psalm 78 is meant to say to us. Secondly, watch your heart. Watch your heart. Pay attention to who you are inside. Pay attention to what your thoughts, where your thoughts are directed, and whether loyalty in your heart is being developed, whether you are the kind of person who can make a commitment and stay with it. At the end of verse 8, the problem with the fathers is that they were a generation whose heart wasn't steadfast and whose spirit wasn't faithful. And what's at stake as this psalm developed is whether people can believe God and trust Him. And in verses 36 and 37, whether we can be honest with Him and our hearts can be steadfast to Him, and whether we can be faithful to His covenant. Am I that kind of person? I don't get to be 35 and then get to start thinking about that. I have to start thinking about it when I'm younger, or at least I need to. Pay attention to your heart. Watch your heart. Let it be faithful and steadfast. That doesn't mean perfect. You won't be all at once, but faithful and steadfast. Number three, relate to God in everything. Remember Him, yes, but think of Him. Think of how He feels. Give consideration to what God thinks. He blesses abundantly in this psalm. He wants His people to respond to Him with love and faithfulness. When they don't, the words that are used are personal and emotional. He's grieved or provoked or moved with jealousy for the ones He loves, but He cares about them. He gets angry when they destroy themselves or their relationship to Him. His distress is real. His wrath occurs. Think of how God feels while you go through your life from day to day, wherever you are over these next 3 or 4 months. He remembers us. The question of our lives is whether we can remember Him. And then fourth, I say this to all of us, be patient with yourself in the middle of this. That'll make you patient with people you love. It'll make you patient with people you deal with every day. I think it's a big issue in this psalm. I want to call your attention back to verse 3 and verse 8. Notice in verse 3, these are things we have known and heard that our fathers told us. Skip down to verse 8. But they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation whose heart was not steadfast. What does that tell you? You and I are called to try to live up to something that the people who told it to us were not able to live up to perfectly. Every generation has to deal with the gap between what its ideals are and it hopes for and what it actually can get done. And it's in that gap that our need for God and the work of His Son gets shown. This whole psalm lets us see our need for the Lord. So I say to each one of us, in these school days where we're learning to be what God wants us to be, set your confidence in God. Remember His works. Keep His words. Learn to live with an upright heart. This psalm ends with David being given the privilege of shepherding God's heritage, His people. You and I know that David and his family proved to have their own weaknesses. Not all of his descendants had steadfast hearts or faithful hearts or upright hearts. God had to do what he did all the way through. When his people failed and they met their judgment, he showed them mercy. He interceded, but he didn't always start back with the same individuals. So another descendant of David comes. Another son of David arises to be the ruler and to shepherd his people, Matthew 2 and verse 6. And when that son of David begins to teach and begins to speak, he makes it clear that he's present to do what David otherwise would not get done. Listen to the words of Jesus in Matthew or in John chapter 10 against the background we've read today. I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. John 10, verse 10b. Then verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Then skipping down a little bit to verse 18. Verse 17 and 18. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father. Psalm 78 leaves us in the need of a shepherd. The Scriptures promise it. Jesus is it. Today, are you in the care of the Good Shepherd and in possession of abundant life? If you're not, you have opportunity to make the good confession, to be baptized into His name, where God promises to do for you what He did for the people in Psalm 78, to forgive you, to forgive us, to help us as we go along. And then after we sing this song, we're going to remember that shepherd's work. We're going to remember that he laid down his life for us, because it had to be done or we would have been lost. Today, if you need to come to the Lord, then as we stand and sing this next song, you let your need be known by coming here to us while we stand and sing.